The door at the back of Bewley Hall opened sharply, and in came a rugged-looking man, probably between 30 and 50 years of age, striding purposely towards me, right up to the front with his eyes firmly fixed on me. I didn't know he was coming. I certainly wasn't expecting this confrontation anyway. He came from nowhere. My name is Ahab, and I'm the king of the northern tribes of Israel here in Gilead, to the east of the river Jordan. And the stranger who came in from the back of the hall and strode towards me was blunt in what he said. He wasn't unfriendly looking, but he spoke, "As the Lord God of Israel liveth, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word." I was stunned when he said that. My heart skipped a beat. I'm afraid I knew why he was there. He continued to look straight at me for a while with a determined stare, just for a moment, and then, having given his message, he suddenly turned on his heel and walked back the way he came, and the door slammed behind him. I wasn't expecting that, and the whole of the people around me were in absolute shock, and silence filled the room. Now, if we go forward 3,000 years to this afternoon, what was going on? Probably it's no surprise to you, that was Elijah. That was God's prophet from about the 9th century BC, some 3,000 years ago now, as we retell the story, the account, and there's some learning and lessons that we can learn from this subject of the prophets at Baal. So let's look at that account and see what we can learn from it. It's 1 Kings 18. I won't take you too far from 1 Kings 18, King James Version, as you would like to turn there, if you're in the habit of turning. And it's like a Bible study in one sense, but having gone through the account, which we will do blow by blow, verse by verse, we'll draw some lessons from the account for us today, 3,000 years later. But just to start, when I came into contact with the Worldwide Church of God in 1967, hard to believe 55 years now, the name of Elijah was on many people's lips. Those of you of that vintage will remember that. And Mr. Armstrong was said by some to possibly be in an Elijah-like role. Do you remember that? Prior to the return of Christ, turn the hearts of the children to the fathers, fathers to the children. Last verse of Malachi. Now, I was a cradle Methodist. I've been a Methodist 25 years. I found that thought new and rather exciting about Elijah and bringing it up to date in 1967 at that time. And even some of the church members gave their children one of the names Elijah. In fact, down in Essex Church, there's a newborn who better remain nameless who has the name of Elijah even today. And the Bricket Wood Music Department in those days had a long time been rehearsing Felix Mendelssohn's oratorio, Elijah. Do you know the name of Mendelssohn? You'll know. He wrote an oratorio called Elijah, which is a cracking oratorio, about 2.5 hours. We're not going to play it today. In fact, I played a bit of it, like 6 minutes at Bewley, but it's not practical on the system. Actually, I could have seen the system and brought it along, but I won't. It's too late now. But anyway, we were rehearsing Elijah. It was a kind of a Victorian oratorio of great repute, and it's sung around the world today, English and German. It was first sung with Mendelssohn conducting in the Birmingham Town Hall in 1846 in English. And it's a fine oratorio, if you like that sort of thing. And the Bricket Wood Music Department had been rehearsing it for a long time. In fact, they sent Mr. Armstrong, kind as he was in these areas, sent the chorale from Bricket Wood across to Pasadena in 1968. I was a bit too late to join that particular group. And they joined with Pasadena and they sang the Elijah in California in the summer of 68. Edward Smith was there and others whose name you will know. Edward Smith and Irene attend the Essex congregation down in Bewley. In fact, later on, we did have the opportunity of singing in the Elijah in the Watford Town Hall. And John Pritchard, Sir John Pritchard, conducted us all. And Mr. Armstrong was in attendance. It was quite a telling the story of Elijah in 1 Kings 18. That's what I'm trying to say. So let's build our story that we all know, but we can always know it deeper. And I'll dramatize it a little bit in a way, not to embarrass you, but make it live a little bit. And we'll see a man of like passions as we are. It says that in the Bible, a man who got depressed despite his magnificent godly role, because he was responsible via God for 8 massive miracles at that time. Even his assistant, who became his successor, Elisha, performed 16 miracles. So it's a classic, unbelievable time to Israel in those days concerning the weather and so on. And there's some earthly humor in it, you might know, and so on. The Bible holds back on nothing. But it's a story of discouragement after a great triumph, depression. It shows the hand of God working on the people of Israel, his chosen people at that particular time. And it goes from exhilaration down to exhaustion, as we'll see as we go through the story. The account of the encounter with the prophets of Baal is probably the most thought-provoking episodes in the Hebrew Bible, because it's a very dramatic story. It's right on top of the stories, if not the very top of prophetic accounts and encounters in the Old Testament. It's about 860 BC, something like that. Elijah was probably middle-aged at this time, being born about 900. He died about 850. And it would be before the captivities of north and south, probably 150 before the years before the Assyrian captivity, and about 250 years before the Babylonian captivity of Judah in the south. Main players in order of appearing, God, of course, Ahab, whom I was representing when we started the sermon. Ahab was a Tishbite from Gilead, which is the western part of Jordan today. Elijah, whose name is over 100 times in the Old Testament, New Testament. El, of course, denotes God, like Elijah, Elisha. Elias in the New Testament, that's the equivalent of Elijah, Elias. Means Yahweh is my God. There's an unnamed widow woman. She's not given a name, but she's widowed. And her son, who also is nameless to us, in Zarephath, which in the New Testament is known as Sarepta, just slightly different. It's a coastal city on the Sidon side. Then you get Obadiah, who was a servant of Ahab. You'll remember his name. Jezebel. Boo, you know, when he comes to Jezebel. Ahab's wife, the wife of the king of Israel at that time, Ahab, daughter of Ethbaal, the king of Tyre and Sidon on the coast. So you've got syncretism here. You've got a mixture of the pagan side of things and Israel, who were going down the tubes at this particular time of history. Also, in order of appearing, 450 prophets of Baal. That's a lot of people, 450. But there are also 400 prophets of the groves in addition to 450 Baal. Baal or Baal, however you want to see it, itself or himself, or however we should say it, who is a Canaanite god. So you can see already we've got trouble coming here. If Ahab's married as king of Israel under God's authority to a Jezebel-like lady with pagan origins, you know you could write the story yourself. Then an angel is there. Then there's a man called Hazael, H-A-Z-A-E-L, who's anointed by Elijah as king over Syria. And then you have 700 faithful Israelites. Now Elijah thinks he's the only one, remember that? I'm the only one left. But there are 700 that he hadn't accounted for. So there's also a lot of people here. And there are more actors, you might say, if we have time. So let's go back a chapter to 1 Kings 17. We'll just speed up towards the main event. 1 Kings 17:1. Elijah the Tishbite, first time Elijah's mentioned in the Bible, 1 Kings 17:1. Who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said to Ahab, remember that encounter I was mimicking as this man strode in from the back of the hall. And he said, and repeated, as the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there's not going to be dew or rain these years, but according to my word. Now, he didn't say, by the way, I have an appointment to tell you something. He was strong, powerful, said his message, and left. And it was to be 3 years or more, wasn't it, till something happened and rain came. And this might have been about 6 months before the drought and the famine, of course, that came with it. And 17:2, the word of the Lord came to him, to Elijah, saying, "Get you hence and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan." So God intervened to Elijah again and said, "You better get out of here, hide yourself, and it shall be," verse 4, "that you shall drink of the brook that I have commanded the ravens. I have also commanded the ravens to feed you there." Don't know how that happened, the ravens being commanded, because God can do that through angels, I expect, messengers working with birds, and they would bring food to him. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. Well, he was God's prophet. For he went and dwelt by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan, and the ravens brought him bread and flesh in the morning and bread and flesh in the evening, and he drank in the brook. So he was okay for, you know, bread and meat and drink. Bit of a boring diet, I suppose. He's got 6 months of this, a bit like manna, I suppose, all the time. Oh, not manna again. I had that last week. I had it last year. And verse 17, it came to pass after a while that the brook dried up because there'd been no rain in the land. So after 6 months, you know, it started to bite, this drought. And then 17:8, we get the widow of Zarephath story. The word of the Lord came to him, to Elijah, saying, "Time to get up." Verse 9, "Get you to Zarephath, which belongs to Zidon," it's on the coast, "and stay there, dwell there. I've commanded a widow woman there to look after you, to sustain you." So he arose, he went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, the widow woman was there gathering sticks. Whether she knew this was coming, I don't know, but at least it was an unavoidable encounter. And he called to her and said, "Fetch me," said Elijah, "a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And as she was going to fetch it, he called to her and said, "Bring me, I pray you, also a morsel of bread in your hand." So he's kind of looking after himself here, because she's in trouble herself. Because she said in 12, "As the Lord your God lives," now she didn't say my God, she said your God, I don't have a cake, but I've got a handful of meal in a barrel and a little oil in a cruse. And this is a stunner, isn't it? "Behold, I'm gathering two sticks that I may go in and dress it for me and my son, that we may eat it and die." This is their last supper. They're in a difficult situation. And Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Fear not. Go and do as you said, but make me thereof a little cake first." Interesting how this is working out. "And bring it to me, and after you can make for you and for your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel," this must have put a bit of backbone in her spine, "the barrel of meat is not going to waste, and the cruse of oil won't fail till the day the Lord sends rain on the earth." So for 3 years, she's going to be okay. Keep pouring, dear. It's always going to be coming out of this barrel. It reminds me of Tommy Cooper. So you remember Tommy Cooper and all these tricks he did with bottles of whiskey and pulling up? Do you remember that? There was a bottle of whiskey here. But out of apparently just one tube, all these bottles of whiskey used to appear. So she was very happy to know that at least her oil would be not wasting and the meal wouldn't waste until the Lord sends rain upon the earth. Verse 15, "And she went and did according to the saying of Elijah, and she and he and her house did eat many days. And the barrel of meal didn't waste, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke by Elijah." She must have been gobsmacked by that, because that's not something which normally happens, you know. The milk bottle empties after a pint of milk, or whatever it is, a litre of milk's got out. And then, more exciting things in 17, "It came to pass after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick, and his sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him." Don't know how old this son was. "And she said to Elijah, what have I to do with you, O man of God? You come along to call my sin to remembrance and slay my son." She was very confused. You can imagine that. "And he said to her, give me your son. And he took him out of her bosom." She was looking after him, her only child, that widow of Nain, I suppose. "And carried him up into a loft where he abode and laid him upon his own bed." So he had a top flat, did Elijah, in this widow's house. And he cried to God and said, O Lord my God, have you also brought evil upon the widow with whom I sojourned by slaying her son? So he was pretty direct to God because he didn't know all the details of what was going on. God did, of course. And he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray you let this child's soul come into him again. Now we don't know, commentaries don't know, you can't say whether he's dead or alive, this son, or in a deep term coma or something. But you imagine, he went up to his loft, took the kid and asked God to take care of this. He carried the kid up, so he wouldn't have been an adult, I wouldn't think. But anyway, light enough to carry up to his top flat, and he stretched himself upon the child and cried to God. There's a parallel to this, interestingly. I'll read it to you. You needn't turn except for your notes, maybe, in verse 34, chapter 4. And this is 2 Kings 4:34. And Elisha went up and lay upon the child, put his mouth upon... This is Elisha now, not Elijah. But it's a similar situation in 2 Kings 4:34. Elisha went up, lay upon the child, another child, and put his mouth upon his mouth. It's like artificial respiration, isn't it? And his eyes upon his eyes, and his hands upon his hands, and he stretched himself upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. Unusual situations. You just put your thoughts and mind as if you were there. And he returned and walked in the house to and fro, went up again, stretched himself, Elisha, upon him, and the child sneezed seven times, and the child opened his eyes. Interesting, you know, you think, that's an unusual situation. And it reminds you, I expect, when Paul was preaching, remember, till midnight, and he was going on, Paul was, and the chap up in the rafters there fell asleep and fell down and knocked himself out, at least probably killed him, and Paul also took him into his hands and said, he's going to be okay, but that's what comes if you preach too long. This is where you're sitting down here, so... And back to 1 Kings 17:22 this time, back to Elijah. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. Imagine what that did to the mum. Like the widow of Nain receiving her only child back again in the New Testament. And Elijah took the child, brought him down out of the chamber, into the house, and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, your son lives. And the woman said to Elijah, now by this I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth as truth. She may not have known till this time, because, let's face it, there was no precedent for this, and she hadn't got a history book to read what we're reading, and it just came out of the blue. God knew, but they didn't. 18 verse 1, here we are, chapter 18. And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go and show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. And again, we'll look at the things we can learn from this and be encouraged at the end of this little Bible study. So 18:2, Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Probably a miracle to meet Ahab after all of that. And there was a sore famine in Samaria, so it's really biting, this famine. And Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of Ahab's house. Obadiah was a governor of the king of Israel, Ahab's house. And Obadiah was, unlike Ahab, he feared God greatly. He got it all together. But Ahab had been compromised by Jezebel, his wife. For it was so when Jezebel cut off, that means killed, the prophets of the Lord, so there's a lot of bloodshed here, that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them in a cave by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. Usual diet, more bread and water, but they at least were hidden by 50s. And Ahab, verse 5, said to Obadiah, go into the land unto all fountains of water, unto all brooks. Peradventure we may find grass to save the horses and the mules alive, that we lose not the beasts. So they divided the land between them. This is Obadiah and Elijah. They divided the land between them to pass through it. And Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself to see what was left of grass to make sure these people were preserved. And Obadiah was in the way. Behold, Elijah met him, and he knew him and fell on his face and said, are you that, my lord Elijah? And verse 8, he answered him, I am. Go and tell the Lord, behold, Elijah is here. Oops. And Obadiah said, what have I sinned that you would deliver your servant to the hand of Ahab to slay me? If I go to see him, he's going to kill me. You know that? You wanted me to go see this guy? My Lord, Ahab, as the Lord God, your God lives, verse 10, there is no nation or kingdom whether my Lord has not sent to seek you. He's been hunting you. Ahab's been after your hide. And when they said he's not there, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation. They found you, they found you not. And now you say, go and tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from you, that the Spirit of the Lord shall carry you whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab that he can't find you, he's going to kill me. But I, your servant, fear the Lord from my youth. And verse 13, was it not told my Lord what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men in the Lord's presence, prophets by 50 in a cave, and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go and tell your Lord, behold, Elijah's here. He's going to kill me, repeats himself. And Elijah said, look, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. It's going to happen. And it's all portrayed in Elijah. It's a fantastic oratorio because this story is sung out and it's very dramatic. In fact, Queen Victoria went to the first performance with Albert, and Mendelssohn was conducting it and all of this. So they all knew this story. And it came to pass, verse 17, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to Elijah, are you he that troubles Israel? They hadn't met for 3 years and 6 months. And Elijah said, I haven't troubled Israel, but you and your father's house, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed Balaam. We should remember the king and the people had reverted to idol worship because, you know, we're great spectaculars. It was an external show. It didn't engage the inner soul of the people, but the people were all excited. There was emotional in this worship that he had, and the king of Israel had enticed the people under his wife to get into all this great show of supposed religiosity. And verse 19, now therefore send... So he's giving orders, is Elijah, to Ahab. Go, send and gather all Israel to Mount Carmel, 2,000-foot mountain. Some of you, some of us have been there. Mount Carmel. Did we go up Carmel? We did, I think.
I don't remember.
You don't remember that one?
Back in 1990.
I know, it's 22 years ago. No, more than that, is it? 32 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah, 32 years ago. Before Putin came to don't go there. I often think of Putin and I think of some of these kings who went off course, you know. Because it's the same old story, same old, same old. You can look at Hitler, you could look at Pol Pot, you can see the same pattern, you know, Germany in the 1930s. And there's nothing going to sway him except extinction, but how's that going to work? Anyway, I mustn't get into that subject because it's rather contentious. Anyway, send and gather to me all Israel to Mount Carmel, prophets of Baal. So 450 people under orders. You think the king would say, no way I'm doing this. But he was in a rock and a hard place, the king. And the prophets of the groves, 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. Get them all together. We've got nearly 1,000 people because something's going to happen here. We're going to find out who the true God is, Ahab. So verse 20. So Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel, gathered the prophets together to Mount Carmel. Elijah came to all the people and said, how long halt you between two opinions? He's got 1,000 people before him. And he's saying, okay, you've got two choices. You're going to choose. How long are you going to stop in the middle? You can't do that. If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people answered not a word. Deathly silence. The sound of silence. Shh. Then said Elijah to the people, I, even I only, remain a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, there were 700, you know, but Elijah didn't know that. He thought he was the only one. Let them, therefore, give us two bullocks. So here we all are. Elijah said, okay, you've got two choices here, either the way you're going or the way I'm representing. Let's take two bullocks, let them choose one bullock for themselves, cut it into pieces. This is a bit bloody, isn't it? Choose one bullock for themselves, lay it on the wood, Don't put fire under it, and I will dress the other bullock and lay it on the wood and put no fire under it. So he's giving orders, and he's saying, okay, we're going to have exactly the same situation here. Just imagine it, lovely sunny day, probably in the Middle East there, 2,000 feet up, about 1,000 people all around, Ahab's there. I know where Jezebel is, but she's aware of all these things. And verse 24, and you call on the name of your God, small g, gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God that answers by fire, let him be God. And all the people answered, yeah, it's well spoken. Perhaps they thought, okay, you're going to go down, Elijah, and our God's going to stand up, and he's going to do all sorts of good things. You know the story, but let's just hype it up a little bit and see what's said. And Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose you one bullock for yourselves, dress it first for your many, and call upon the name of your gods, but don't put any fire under it. So he repeats it. You see the drama here. And why do they took it as an oratorio? And verse 26 of 1 Kings 18, they took the bullock which was given them and they dressed it. That's all. Way the King James puts it, dressing a bullock. But they, you know, they made it ready. And called on the name of Baal from morning to noon. And you've got hours here saying, oh, Baal, hear us. Hear us, Baal. Baal. Shouting and screaming away and jumping up and down, cutting themselves. This is, you know, pagan religions do that. There's a lot of external stuff and excitement and adrenaline flowing. But there was no voice. Nobody answered, and they leaped upon the altar which was made, because they used to get some answers from Baal. You know, there were demons involved here, of course, because Satan wants to infiltrate and kill God's people, and Satan and the demons are allowed around today, being used or using human beings to scrape humanity off the planet so Satan can be top dog. But as was said by Greg Williams, and I hadn't actually appreciated that, you know, in the temptation, the wilderness, your foot won't dash against a stone. And he made the point, Greg Williams made the point, the next verse does talk about vipers and everything else. And he said that, you know, Satan doesn't know his scriptures, because the next verse to that, which Satan didn't quote, of course, would have shown that actually it's going to turn the other way around. Did you catch that on the Word of Life that Greg Williams was saying? The next verse to that one is that actually it relates to Satan, because you're going to be protected from Satan. Just a thought as we go through. It's all context, isn't it? And it came to pass, verse 27, at noon that Elijah mocked them. He said, cry aloud, keep going. He's a god. Either he's talking, he gets sarcastic here, or he's pursuing on the toilet, actually, or he's in a journey. Or peradventure, perhaps he's asleep, must be awakened. You know, he's pouring the sarcasm on, isn't he, in verse 27. You know, some of the people in the Bible are not polite, just the opposite at times. The Bible pulls no punches, you know, abuse, exaggeration, obscenity. These all seem, in the Old Testament at least, to be acceptable modes of talking about things. A lot of irony and sarcasm, even some bawdy humour. You know, we don't think of those things sometimes, but God makes it quite clear. You're dealing with carnal people here, and Elijah is saying, look, maybe he's on the John, maybe he's asleep. You know, shout louder, because he's not getting the point, is he? Do you see that? And they cried aloud, verse 28, cut themselves after their manner with knives and lances till blood gushed up out upon them. You just imagine this, right? Hundreds of people shouting out. We see some of that in parts of the world today in various distresses. And it came to pass when midday was over, they prophesied till the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, on and on, dragging it through, that there was neither voice nor any to answer, and nobody regarded. It was wasted time. And Elijah said to all the people, come to me, come near to me. And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down. Elijah took 12 stones, like the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord said, saying, Israel shall be your name. And verse 32, and with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. Watch, they're all watching on, knowing that their bit hasn't worked out. And he made a trench around about the altar, as great as contained two major. So he built everything up here. Somehow he found some water, poured it in the burnt sacrifice and on the. even though there's a drought, there's some stored water or something. So he sloshes it all around to, you know, show that fire is going to be dominant in this area. And he said, do it another time, second time. They did it. He said, do it a third time. So he's getting all these prophets of Baal to do the work for the altar. So three times they ramped up the opportunity for nothing to happen because there was soaking water everywhere. And he said, by fire, God's going to work this out. And the water ran around the altar, and he filled the trench also with water. Verse 36, now it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Jacob, Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Now, they didn't have a loud speaker system, but they were able to all hear this. Probably the clear mountain air gathered together, his voice would carry. 18-second prayer, you know, sometimes even a less than half a minute prayer has great consequences. We should remember that. Then, verse 38, the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. Bang! Can you imagine that? Fire from heaven to consume everything. You imagine people getting out of the way of this lot. Just think of it. Setting fire to water. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces like an atomic explosion. And they said, the Lord, he's God. The Lord, he's God. And Elijah said to them, take the prophets of Baal. Don't let any one of them escape. How many? 450. And they took them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. Killed them. How? It doesn't say. Wow. Extraordinary. Even though they were saying, you know, the Lord is God. Yes, okay, you win, you win. You're dead men. Now, thank God for a resurrection, brethren. They'll live again. They'll understand. And there'll be a dramatic story that will be retold through the generations to come. 1841, Elijah said to Ahab, come on, get up, eat and drink. In other words, have a party. Because there's rain coming. Now this drama has been over. Have a party, Ahab, because rain is... Ahab must have been absolutely... I don't know what you would say. Depressed, certainly. He must have been, ghastly days. You know, I understand a bit now. I wonder if when Elijah met Ahab as he entered Jezreel, Elijah said, I told you so, it was going to rain. I told you it was going to rain. Verse 42, Ahab went up to eat and drink. So he kind of went and sustained himself. And Elijah went to the top of Carmel, cast himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees and said to his servant, he's praying now that rain would come, right? You're on top of Carmel. Go up now, look toward the sea, looking west, right, over the Mediterranean. And little child went up in the Elijah oratorio, it's a soprano voice, and looked and said, there's nothing. He said, go up seven times. So seven times, this little chap went up, had a look out, said, no, I don't see anything. I don't see any rain. It wasn't the first. God doesn't always work the first time, does he? And he went up another time, seven times, six times, I see nothing. Don't see. But at the seventh time, it came to pass at the seventh time, verse 44, that he said, hey, look, there rises a little cloud out of the sea like a man's hand. You know, I know you know the story. I'm just hamming it up a little bit so we can put some edge on it. But like a man's hand at a distance. Okay, there's a cloud coming up. My hand will cover it at the moment. Surely that's not going to help us very much. And he said, go up and say to Ahab, prepare your chariot, get you down, that the rain doesn't stop you. We're going to have a flood. And it came to pass in the meanwhile that the heaven was black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, Elijah did, and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. What's going on there, I don't know, whether the supernatural movement of people around in long distances in short times. 19:1, verse 1 of chapter 19, and Ahab told Jezebel all the things Elijah had done. So Jezebel wasn't there, but she certainly got an earful when Ahab came back. And withal, how he'd slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. He's a hunted man, isn't he? Saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. She hadn't learned anything. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life. After all the power that threw him, he was scared for his life. Came to Beersheba, which was about 100 miles down to Beersheba. So he went way down south to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah in the south, and left his servant there. He wants to get as far away as possible from Jezebel's fury. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and he sat down under a juniper, or broom tree apparently, and he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, look, it's enough, O Lord, now. Take away my life. I'm not better than my fathers. I'm not better than my fathers. I think that last verse is something we can all remember. You know, we're just human beings. We have all been broken, who are now Christians, and been healed by Christ, but we're not better than our fathers. We can bring nothing to this world of any vital new import to God until God had his hand on us. So you might think he's a bit paranoid here, but he lay down and slept. He managed to get a wink or two under the juniper tree, and an angel touched him and said, come on, get up, time to eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. He thought, I've seen this before somewhere. And he ate and drank and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again, second time, touched him and said, come on, eat again, for the journey is too great for you unless you eat something. So he arose, did eat and drink, and he went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Horeb, the Mount of God. So maybe the 40 days and 40 nights associates him with Moses, you might remember. But it's in that cave that Elijah despairs again. 19:9. He came hither into the cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said, God said, what are you doing here, Elijah? God knew what he was doing there. He said, Elijah, what's all this about? And Elijah said, I've been very jealous for the Lord of hosts. For the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. They've slain your prophets with the sword. It's only me that's left. And they want to kill me as well, take my life away. And God said, okay, go forth, stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, God passed by, remember this, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. Now that's quite a wind that breaks the rocks. But God wasn't in the wind. But after the wind, here's Elijah having just almost had his clothes torn off by this tornado. There came an earthquake. He wouldn't stand up. Actually, he's almost thrown off balance. But no, God wasn't in the earthquake. And after a fire, oh, not fire again, man! But the Lord wasn't in the fire. But after that, a still, small voice. Reminds me of Samuel. Do you remember Samuel, a little boy, saying, Samuel, Samuel, here I am. I didn't ask for you. Go back to sleep again. So God whispered after this drama of, you know, the earthquake, the wind and the fire, the word, a very still, small voice. God was in the whisper that followed, the sound of a gentle breeze, you might say, his comforting presence in the calm. And you also remember, not by might or by power, but by my spirit, says God. He was dejected, was Elijah, of course, because of the failure of the grand gesture. He knew his victory was short-lived and he'd lost the battle for the future. And he realized only God's way of encouraging and helping can sustain somebody who's involved in, you know, an internal encounter with a still small voice of God. What's Elijah to think in all of this? Well, 19:13, it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle. He went out and stood in the entrance of the cave and looked. There came a voice to him saying, what are you doing here? And it goes on the same way now in 19:13 and all the way through. So we could amplify the story more and more. What else can we say? It's in the New Testament as well. I've come to the end of the story. We should learn some lessons from what was said. Elijah was taken up in a chariot of fire. You remember at the end of his life when he realized he wasn't the only one. There were 7,000 others. Or is it 700? 700 or was it 7,000? 700 other prophets, I think, that he didn't know about. But then he was taken up by a chariot of fire. This is 2 Kings 2:11 for your notes. and appeared to a chariot of fire and horses of fire that parted them both asunder. And Elijah, in order to let Elisha start his ministry, Elijah went up by whirlwind into heaven. And people think he went to heaven, but he didn't. He was just taken out of the scene. And in 2 Corinthians 21:12, there's a letter from him somewhere else. So he didn't die. He wasn't taken into heaven. No man's ascended to heaven. But if you want to note 2 Chronicles 21:12, there's apparently a note or an epistle or a letter from Elijah after this account. So he was obviously somewhere else and taken away to be away from the centre of action. And, you know, 9-10 chapters in 1 Kings. Transfiguration, you know, remember it was Elijah and Moses and Jesus Christ in the Transfiguration. Elijah appears there. And they thought in the crucifixion that Elijah would save him. Elijah appears as a major prophet in all these areas. And that verse in Malachi, you shall go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah, turn the hearts of the fathers of children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord, as quoted in Luke 1:17, prophetically. Of course, John the Baptist was a forerunner. And we note in James 5:17, he was a man, Elijah was, subject to like passions. He's just human being like we are, that God got hold of and used for a great drama. And he prayed earnestly that it might not rain, it rained not on the earth for 3 years and 6 months. So that's mentioned in James 5:17. So, you know, there are many massive miracles in the Bible, but the Old Testament one is hard to top what we've just been through in the last few minutes. Now, if you get Word for Today, United Christian Broadcasters, I thought this was helpful. What to do when you feel down? You know, I know that David Head feels down at the moment, and we're talking about other people who've got depressed and down. Naturally, you can understand it. And about Elijah, this is every day, Word for Today brings out a thought for the day, doesn't it? United Christian Broadcasters up in Stoke. This is what they say about Elijah. Elijah got so down that he was ready to end it all. And it happened on the heels of his greatest victory. He had just called down fire from heaven on Mount Carmel when he went from exhilaration to exhaustion. We forget that even when we are successful and love what we do, it can be physically, mentally, and emotionally draining. I mean, after all of that, you can imagine you use adrenaline up, it kind of weakens you out, doesn't it? When that adrenaline settles down, you feel weak at the knees. And he was like passions like we are. He's just a human being, but God used him like God uses you in different times. Not so many dramatic times as physically in the Old Testament, but far more dramatic times spiritually of things that God is doing that we're not always aware of through his Spirit in the new dispensation of the new covenant. So if you're a purpose-driven person with no boundaries, pay attention. One, exhaustion made Elijah lose perspective. He had just defeated 850 false prophets. And now he was turning from one woman, Jezebel, running from one woman, Jezebel. General George Patton, Jr. said, quote, "Fatigue makes cowards of us all. When fatigue walks in, faith walks out." It continues to say in Word for Today. "It distorts our thinking and makes us overlook God's powers and his promises." We've all got down from time to time. It's a natural human condition when things happen. Mental fatigue coupled with physical exhaustion is a deadly combination that invites hopelessness and creates the illusion that we have no options. Secondly, fear made Elijah isolate himself. Leaving his servant in Beersheba, he went into the wilderness and told God, "I'm the only one left. They're trying to kill me now." At that moment, Elijah was in the worst possible company, his own. When you feel down, that isn't the time to isolate yourself. That's when you need to reach for people and the people who love you and can help you get back up. I'll stop there and say, just last week I visited somebody who's, I remain nameless of course, one of the most humble people I've ever met, church member, and he had tinnitus in his ears and he was feeling bad and he wasn't sleeping well and he does Meals on Wheels and can't do what... A lovely guy, but, you know, he's just feeling down. I thought, I must go and see him. We had a lovely time, went for a carvery meal. And, you know, just visiting and talking to someone else picked him up. He's by himself. He doesn't have a wife. And, you know, we're all there to encourage other people who do get down and get things wrong at times. Even Paul needed help. After writing in Macedonia, we, quote, found trouble all around us, fighting on the outside and fear on the inside. And Paul added, but God, who comforts those who are troubled, comforts us when Titus came. So what do you need to call? Who do you need to call? Who do you need to reach for? Don't keep putting it off. I thought that was very good. Jesus needed to rest from his madding crowd that followed him. Elijah was certainly exhausted. We can all have adrenaline low. Just looking at my notes here. Sometimes zealous courage can be followed by feelings of despondency. Elijah certainly had reasons to fear walking by sight. But God, of course, often does the unexpected, and that's exactly what happened here, the still small voice and so on. And Jesus tells us, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. I'm going to give you rest. So it goes. And I think we all, whether Christian or not, we all go through these cycles of life. And being converted does not inoculate us against some of these problems. That's why we need to stand by people and be there for people, because we're all going to go through it one way or the other. And many of you here know what I mean. Death of a loved one, illness and so on. Even Christ said, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. I remember Gethsemane. But for this cause came I into the world. Glorify your name, Father. I mean, Christ must have, what he shed that blood as a few vessels broken his forehead in the events we're going to celebrate in the next couple, 3 weeks. So Jesus Christ, the human being Jesus Christ, wasn't immune from all of this, and that we can take comfort that. So Paul said, if you're noting as we come towards the end, clock's wrong, obviously. Coming towards the end, in 2 Corinthians 4, first verse, a few verses. Therefore, having this ministry, he said to the Corinth church, by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart, said Paul. We are afflicted every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not driven to despair. We are persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed, knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise also us up with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence, so we don't lose heart. And you can also think about, you know, shipwrecks and beatings and so on. And he also says in that chapter, in that verse, that book, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, for which cause we don't faint, but though our outward man perish, you know, this kicks in well, doesn't it? Paul said, look, though our outward man perish, yet inwardly, the inward man's renewed day by day. We can call upon God and he will come when he's ready. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And that light affliction for a moment might be a lifetime for some. But eventually, all is going to work. And 2 Corinthians 4:18, if you're noting, for while we don't look at things which are seen, well, how can you look at something which isn't seen? It's an oxymoron. We look at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal. That's all. This lovely hall one day will go, for example. But the things which are not seen are, they are eternal. So hopefully that's encouragement and comfort to all of us in our various stages and ways of being discouraged, maybe about how the church is facing the future, and Leviticus 13 and the Holy Leviticus 11 and 14. I figured which is Leviticus 23 and all the holy days and the things the church has to decide upon. You know, it's going to come for discomfort and fear for many people about the way that we were and the way that the church wishes to be. And I would just end with a poem by Edgar Guest, whom I hadn't heard of. I knew the poem, a very short one. Guest was British, but moved into America, 1881, 1959. He says this, remember this? When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, and the road you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, gas bill, and you want to smile, but you have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but do not quit. Life is queer with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns, and many a failure turns about, when he might have won, but had he stuck it out. Don't give up, though the pace seems slow. You may succeed with another blow. Often the goal is nearer than it seems to the faint and faltering man, woman. Often the struggler has given up when he might have captured the victor's cup. And he learned too late when the knight slipped down how close he was to the golden crown. Success is failure turned inside out. The silver tint of the clouds of doubt. And you never can tell how close you are. It may be near when it seems afar. So stick to the fight when you're hardest hit. It's when things seem worst that you mustn't quit. Well, I hope you found that encouraging anyway, and meeting some of our personal needs, as well as thinking about the global arena. So there we go.